Tonight we're going to continue, just take about 20 minutes in our study of the book of Esther and make our way through another two chapters. I was kind of surprised after last Sunday night. I didn't know I was teaching something that you had not heard before. It's what I've always taught about the book of Esther. And so quite a few of you said you had never heard it that way. So you have to forgive me. It's just the way I was taught and the way I see it and the way it seems to be. But we're going to continue in our series from the book of Esther, and we're looking at what God is doing. The old statement is something like this: the best laid plans of mice and men, right? When you have that little statement, the best laid plans of mice and men, we say that because we know that often it is man who makes his plans, but it's the Lord who directs his steps. And so often a person has his plans in mind, and as he makes his way through life, it is actually God who is changing all those things. As you go through the book of Esther, you understand there are three items that really puzzle us as we study the book. The first is the silence of God. There is no mention of God. There's no mention of God's temple, of God's prayer, of anything that has to do with God. It's like God is exempt from this book, and that is why Martin Luther was so opposed to this book and took it out of his Bible. It's why many people, the Jews in fact, could speak negatively about it, because God would never write a book that doesn't have his name in it, and yet it's there. And you have to ask the question, and specifically, why would God not put his name in this book? What's the point of that all, and why would he do it? The second is the slaughter of the 75,000. God would never allow people, his people, to slaughter people, just to kill people. That one's an easy one to solve as we get to the end of the book. And the third one is the state or the condition of Mordecai and Esther. Are they godly or are they ungodly? Are they the top of the pile or the bottom of the pile? And as you go through the book, you're just going to struggle with that as you make your way through this book. As we studied last week from chapter 1 and 2, we understand that it starts with Ahasuerus or Xerxes the First, who was a spectacular king with a spectacular kingdom. You and I understand that often as a kingdom grows in its glory and in its splendor, usually at its height, when it's the most glorious and the most splendid, it is soon going to fall because it just keeps growing. And when it's at its point of height, that's the time you ought to expect it to fall. And that was true for Xerxes because the Greeks were coming on. His father would lose one of the great battles at Marathon, from which we get the word Marathon. He would lose twice to the Greeks as he tried to recover from what his father did. But even in spite of that, he had an impressive kingdom. And that was so impressive that he had people from all over the world. In fact, all the satraps or the governors from all over the 127 provinces come. And the kingdom is impressive. But as you read those verses, you also understand there are some obvious signs of evil. He is not a godly man, and this is not a godly kingdom, and there is major problems in it. And he has a drinking feast. Everything about it, I think it was Ellicott who said, all we know about Xerxes is drunkenness and debauchery. Drunkenness and debauchery. Everything about him, really, when it comes down to it, is drinking feast. So it's impressive, and yet there are obvious signs of evil. And yet Mordecai, and therefore Esther, who was obeying him, had the sense that they could be a part of it. And they tried to be a part of it and ultimately were a part of it. And then as you read it, you understand to be a part of it, Mordecai came to the conclusion, if we're going to be a part of this kingdom, then we have to hide our identity. We cannot let people know that we are Jews. By the way, this is the first place, this in Ezra and Nehemiah, this time is the first place that we have the word Jews in the Old Testament. So suddenly they are not called the children of Israel. They're not called Israelites anymore. They're Jews. It's kind of a biological term. And they thought they needed to hide their identity. And if you hide who you are, then you can be used of God, or you can be used, I should say, in the kingdom where you are. And in spite of all of that, we came to this conclusion at the end of chapter 2. You can find favor with the king. Esther did. She was of great pleasure to him. And you can help the king. And they really did. Mordecai saved the king's life. And you can debate whether they're good or they're bad, but we're going to continue in this. The question that we have to ask today is something like this. So how did it work out, Mordecai? You had this great plan. You're going to hide your identity. You're going to take your niece, who is like your daughter, send her into a beauty contest. When she goes in, she's going to leave the chamber of virgins, spend a night with the king, and come out and be put in the chamber of the concubines. And you're going to hide your identity. And how did it work out? In chapter 3 and chapter 4 is all about how it worked out. Notice what it says in chapter 3 and verse 1. After these things, King Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, promoted Mordecai, the son of... No, I had that wrong, didn't I? That's what you expected, didn't you? If you had not read this book before, having read Daniel, who was promoted, here's a man after these things. He had just told us about Mordecai saved the king's life. Surely the king would reward him in some way. The king would look on him favorably. And so when it says after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted, our next thought is has to be Mordecai. God promoted Daniel. Surely he'll promote Mordecai as well. But he doesn't. He promotes something like this. Haman, the son of Hamada, the Agite. And advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. One of the things that you see immediately is Mordecai is disregarded. He's not promoted. He's not given the great place. He is not given the second place in the kingdom. That's exactly the same place that Daniel had. You remember that? He was given the second place in the kingdom. So God can allow his people to be used in a great way. Now, one of the things interesting is this is Haman, the son of whatever, the Agite. You all know about king of the Agites. They're found in Exodus. They're found in 1 Samuel. They're found in the book of Deuteronomy, the Agites. The Agites were the enemies of the Jewish people. Even back there in the book of Exodus, you remember they're coming out of Egypt. They're going to make their way ultimately to the promised land. And as they make their way, they come to a place called Rephidim, not too far out of Egypt. There's Rephidim. And there the Agites come and they attack the Jewish people at a vulnerable moment. And the Agites therefore disdain Jewish people, the children of Israel coming out, and have always been cursed by God. In fact, Saul, when he was a king, because he did promote relationships with the Agites, was condemned by God for doing that. God and the Agites never had a great place. But another thing that's important to understand is that Xerxes is willing to allow the second man in his kingdom to be somebody who is not a Persian. So Xerxes has no problem with promoting somebody outside of his ethnic group, has no problem promoting somebody who's outside of his political realm, as long as he's in the Persian Empire and he promotes him. It kind of catches us by surprise. But that's not so bad. So I didn't get the promotion. I said I'm going to be a part of this kingdom. I'm going to play by the rules. I'll play by the rules. I'll hide my identity. So the other guy gets the promotion. I don't get it. I'm disregarded. That's not so bad. But notice what happens next as you make your way down there. And all the king's servants who were within the king's gates bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. You understand that in those days, in cultures to this day, it is very common to bow. In certain cultures, when you greet people, we, of course, would shake hands and we stand erect and tall. But in certain cultures, you still have to bow. You understand, as you read the Old Testament and the New Testament, it was very common for God's people to bow to other people out of respect. We understand David bowed to Jonathan. We understand in the Old Testament, several people would bow to other people out of respect. And when you came to the king's entrance, to the palace gates and to the king's entrance of the city, there were the elders. And when you came in, it was only appropriate that you would bow, that you would respect them, that you would show by your actions that you respected them for the position that they had. And here's what happens. Verse 2, they are all bowing and they're paying homage to Haman. There's a little clue here because the king commanded them. Why did he have to command them? If you know the guy's number 2 in the kingdom, you don't need a law about that one. But for Haman, they do. That may give us a little clue what's really going on in regards to Haman and what really people thought. But here's the here's what's really important in verse 2. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. And the king's servants who were within the king's gates said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" And it happened when they spoke to him daily, he would not listen to them, that they told it to Haman to see whether Mordecai's words would stand. For Mordecai had told them that he was a Jew. Suddenly he's changed his strategy. Suddenly he's telling these people, at least, that he was a Jew. And suddenly it's out. The cat's out of the bag. He was hiding it, but now he's open to it. But he refuses to listen to the advice that's given to him, and he refuses to bow down. And as a result of that, in verse 5, when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage, Haman was filled with wrath, and he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout all the kingdom. The second thing that happens to him is this. Not only was he disregarded and didn't get the promotion, but he was disdained. In fact, the truth is, it was not just he who was disdained, but all the children of Israel, the Jewish people, are disdained. And so you can see things are not working out so well. His strategy doesn't seem to be working. He's disregarded. Now it's even worse. He is disdained. As you read through this account, you understand that this is one of many places in history where the Jewish people have been disdained by other people. It is more than likely that Haman and others had an anti-Semitic view of life. It is more than likely that somehow when he found out that they were the Jewish people, especially being an Agite, which had disdained Israel right coming out of Egypt, and their history from Deuteronomy and 1 and 2 Samuel records it, that he had a natural bent against the Jewish people. And when he found out Mordecai was one, and Mordecai refused to show him the respect that was due him, he disdained him. By the way, if you read this account, you can say, perhaps Mordecai was a good guy, or perhaps he was not a good guy. Perhaps he just had this, someone said he had either a loyalty to his principles. God does not want us to bow to people. This is a worship thing, and I'm not doing it because the only one I'm going to bow down is and worship is God. So either it's Mordecai is standing in loyalty to his principles. I will die if that's what it takes, but I will not violate God's word. Or this individual, I think it was Ellicott, said he is either loyal to his principles or he is a big-hearted, proud fool who refuses to bend and respect the man who got the spot that he really wanted. We're not sure either way, and I'm not sure it's important for us to figure out, but it could be either. The point is this, it's not working out so well to hide your identity. It's not working out so well to stand the way you have done. In fact, if this is all a contrast, Esther is a contrast to Daniel, it almost seems like this is a flip-flop. Daniel stood, he openly claimed to be a child of God, he repeatedly prayed. Everything was against him. You would expect Daniel would be the one who was killed. Daniel would be the one who was hated, and in some ways he was. But Daniel's the one who gets promoted, and Daniel's the one who makes it. And now Haman, playing the other game, hiding his identity, I should say Mordecai, playing the other game, he is ending up disregarded and disdained. In fact, as we saw in verse 6, it's not just that he is disdained. There is suddenly a decree that goes out. Here's the decree that goes out. In the first month, verse 7, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that's a lot, before Haman to determine the day and the month until it fell in the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. I'm not sure how you read that. Maybe they kept casting lots until he got the answer he wanted. Did you ever do that? Not that we cast lots, but you look for an answer and, oh, I didn't get it, so I'll try that one again. So it seems to be saying that. In other words, he had it all determined what he wanted, so we'll keep casting lots until I get the right answer. It may be something else, but here's what happens. He finally figures I got 12 months. That's what I need. I need 12 months to pull this one off. And here's what he says in verse 8. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other peoples, and they do not keep the king's law. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. And suddenly, Haman plays Mordecai's game. We'll pretend we don't know who they are. We won't tell you that they're the Jews, and we won't tell you that Mordecai, the guy that saved your life a little while ago, is one of them. And I won't tell you that Esther, Mordecai's niece, is also one of them. I'm just going to pretend it's a people. And you almost sense, as you read through this account, that King Ahasuerus is kind of being duped. He's just not a really smart guy or something like that. Here is Haman, who's manipulating it all, playing his cards correctly. And he's saying, there's this people. They live by their own law. Now, that may be an indication because Jewish people always have. They've always been a problem to the Romans, to anybody who has conquered them and ruled them because they refuse to change the way they do life. They live by their law, which is the law of God. Notice what happens, though. If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed. And I, Haman says this, I'm going to pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hand of those who do the work to bring it into the king's treasuries. So the king has two motives. Number one, these are a group of people in your kingdom somewhere. He doesn't know the guy that saved his life, the woman who is his queen, his pleasing queen, the Jews in his own realm. He thinks there's some group somewhere, he doesn't even know who they are, have failed to keep your law. You can't allow that. They're a threat to you. More importantly, guess what? You're going to benefit from this. Half of a year's income will be given to you. Just imagine how much they take in every year. Now think of the United States government, how much we take in every year. If somebody promised the U.S. government will give you half of a year's income if you do this, there'd be quite a motivation to go along with that scheme and that plan. And King Ahasuerus goes along with it. As you can read, he gives a signet ring to Haman, who is the enemy of the Jews. We are told that. The king does not know that. The king says to Haman, the money and the people are given to you to do with them as seems good. And the king's scribes were called on the 13th day of the first month, and the decree was written according to all that Haman commanded, and to the king's satraps and to the governors who were over each province, to the officials of all the people, and to every province according to its script, and to every people in their language, in the name of King Ahasuerus. It was written and sealed with the king's signet ring. And the letters were sent by couriers into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, to annihilate all the Jews, both men and women. I'm sorry, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their possessions. And a copy of the document was to be issued as the law in every province, being published for all the people that they should be ready for that day. And the couriers went and hastened by the king's command. And the decree was proclaimed in Shushan, the citadel. And so he's having a bad day. Things are not going out and working as he thought they might. He is disregarded and doesn't get the promotion. He's disdained and he's offending a self-serving enemy. He has somebody really mad. Number two in the kingdom is really mad at him. And there is suddenly a decree. And now forced to have a decreed genocide. And suddenly the law is, we're going to take out every Jewish person. Now, King Ahasuerus doesn't know that they're Jews at this point, but that's the decree. But there's one last thing in this chapter, and you picked it up at the end of chapter 3 and verse 15. So the king and Haman sat down to drink. Elicot is right. They just drink and have debauchery. That's what you know about these two men. And they sit down to drink. And the city of Shushan is perplexed. Things are not going well for Mordecai. His plan isn't working as well as he thought it might. He's not been promoted. He's offended. He's now disdained. There's a decree. Not only does it impact his life, his decision to not bow down is now rippled out. So his whole people, all of his people, are decreed for genocide. And the king and number two in the realm are sitting around drinking. And the people are totally confused. When you read that, you understand that the king and Haman are totally oblivious. At least the king is oblivious to what's really going on. They are unconcerned. Haman is a wise manipulator of the system and of the king. And Mordecai has a massive, massive problem. It didn't work out as well as he had thought. And chapter 3 is all downhill, 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 downhill. In fact, as you know, since this is a literary bifed, chapter 1 through 5 is all downhill. Everything's going to go down, down, down until God does something and then we go out of our problem. So what's going to happen in chapter 4? Well, in chapter 4, you have the account. It goes like this. When Mordecai learned all that had happened, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the midst of the city. And he cried out with a loud voice and a bitter cry. You understand that as you read this fourth chapter, the disdain and the decree and the drinking, with all the people just perplexed, like, what is going on? Why would the king make a law like that? I can't understand it, but they can't do anything about it. There's nothing they are or can do about it. That suddenly Mordecai finds himself in total desperation. He who is always at the center of something is suddenly out in the middle of the people, and he is crying. And it is more than just a public show, because sometimes we can do that, or they could do that. I'll fast, I'll tear my clothes, I'll put on this public show. But it's very specific. He cried with a bitter cry. He is one sad man. His plans have not worked. In fact, his people are going to be killed as well. He is not excited about this. And he cries, as you can read there in chapter 4. He went as far as the front of the king's gate, for no one might enter the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. And in every province where the king's command and decree arrived, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and wailing. And many lay in the sackcloth and the ashes. And we understand he is desperate, so desperate that publicly goes out, does the ashes, does the sackcloth, does the fasting. And by the way, you understand that in that culture of that day, you could find it in the scriptures even. Besides, Herodotus would talk about it, the historian, the Greek historian who wrote at this time about this particular event. You would find that sackcloth and ashes and tearing clothes was a cultural thing. That people did it. Saved people did it, or God's people did it. People who weren't God's people did it. When you were sad, when you were grieving, you wanted to do that and you did that. But in the heart of it, Mordecai has a bitter, bitter cry. He is desperate, so desperate that he does this publicly in front of people. And finally, you find in verse 4 these words, Esther's maids and eunuchs and came and told her, and the queen was deeply distressed. And she sent garments to clothe Mordecai, take off his sackcloth, but he wouldn't do it. You could read through that. And suddenly he is crying. His world has fallen apart. And the world of his people has fallen apart. And this man who was playing the system finds out it didn't work out as well as he thought. In fact, you read in verse 7, Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the sum of the money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasurer. He also gave him a copy of the written decree for their destruction, which was given at Shushan, and that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her, that he might command her to go into the king to make supplication to him and plead before him for her people. And so he's one who is crying, and he's so desperate. He now sees this young little niece who is like his daughter. And you remember earlier it said he repented, or he was, he was torn with mourning, and he went to the king's gate. But he knew if he went through it, that the law said anybody who went through the gate who wasn't invited would be killed. And so he doesn't do it. So his solution is, Esther, you go do it. I want you to go see the king. Besides that, you're the queen. You have a much better chance of surviving this one. And so he encourages her. He is desperate, as all of chapter 4 would show you. Her answer, as you read down through it, is exactly what you'd expect. It says this in verse 10. Esther spoke to Hathach and gave him a command for Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court of the king who has not been called, he has but one law: put all to death. And there's one exception, except the one who the king holds out the golden sepulcher that he may live. Yet I myself have not been called to go into the king these 30 days. She said, there's a law, and the law is this: they all die. The general rule is everybody dies. There is an exception. If he wants to, he can hold out the golden sepulcher or scepter, and she or he could live. Mordecai is desperate, publicly crying, going as far as he can, now commanding Esther, go in and do the hard thing. Go in. When she says, I can't, he hasn't called me, and if I go in, I'll probably be killed because that's the general rule. He says this in verse 13, and Mordecai told them to answer Esther, do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. If you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to this kingdom for such a time as this? And Esther said, I'll go. But you have everybody fast as I prepare to go in. We understand he's in great desperation. He's crying. He's commanding his niece to do something that is extremely dangerous for her, something that he himself is not really willing to try. She does have the advantage. She's inside. But both of them would face a law that says you're dead. And so therefore he challenges her. He says, you know, you have to do this, because if you don't, you are raised for such a time as this. If you don't, something else, somebody else will come and rise to this. As you read that, you, of course, are wondering, are they good or are they bad? And as you will read in this book, at the end of it, you will not know if they are godly or ungodly. You will not know if what's driving them is their motivation to honor the Lord or their motivation to do their own thing. When they fast, does that mean they were also praying? Many examples of that in the Old Testament where they fasted and prayed, and in the New Testament fasted and prayed. But Herodotus was very clear as well. In many of those cultures, when you really were desperate, you fasted. And we even have evidence in the Scripture of people who fasted who were not the people of God, and surely they were not praying to God. So you will not know. So why does God keep leaving us like this? And we don't know. Are they good or are they bad? Are they praying to God or are they not praying to God? Why don't they offer sacrifices or are they not offering sacrifices? And he's leaving us there. And as we make our way through the book of Esther, that has to keep being planted in our mind, because that's the point that will lead us to the ultimate point and message of the book of Esther. You do not know whether these are great and godly or the people of God who have learned to compromise, to try to fit in, to try to be a part of the system, to hide their identity, to play the games of the world and see how it works. Here's the question we have. So what do we learn? Well, if we think about it tonight, we probably learn this. Hiding your identity, Mordecai, didn't really work out so well. It didn't give you the promotion. It didn't protect you from his anger. It didn't protect you from the decree. In fact, if you would have told him, and Esther would have told him, it is possible she would not have been selected queen. You don't know that. But it is also possible if she had been selected queen and he knew that she was a Jew, that King Ahasuerus would never have made this decree. You don't know. But hiding your identity and telling people, or telling your niece, don't let them know you're part of the people of God, it didn't work out so well. That's why I love the contrast to Daniel. Against all odds, he bravely told people his convictions and bravely told people his identity. And the one who should have gone down in smoke, Daniel, is the one who rose to the top in spite of the fact he dared to tell people who he was and what he believed and what God wanted him to. Mordecai, hiding your identity didn't work out so well, it doesn't seem to me. We probably learn this. One person can impact so many. And really, as you read this account, there are two one persons. On one side, there's Mordecai. And his decisions and his closeness to the king's court and his actions not only impacts him, but it impacts his niece, who he treats as his own daughter. But then ultimately the entire Jewish nation is going to be impacted by one man's actions. That is a tremendous principle of life. One person in a group can impact all of us. They all faced death because of Mordecai. But you also understand this. On the other side, it was one man by the name of Haman who impacted so many. So that at the end of chapter 3, the people in the city are sitting there perplexed. What is this all about? Why is there a decree like this? My neighbor's a Jew. He's a businessman. He deals with me. And now I have a law that says I have to annihilate him on the 13th day of such and such a month. One man brought this decree and manipulated the king. One man can have tremendous impact in the hearts and lives of people. One of the things that I think you see in here is always amazing to me, the account. This evil man Haman tried and needed to justify what he was doing. That always amazes me. If you're going to commit genocide anyway, why do you need a law that tells you you can do it? And why manipulate the kings and the system so that you get some law across that says you're allowed to do that? If you are that kind of an evil person, why do you do it? But you have seen in history, and I've seen in history, how often people are doing wrong and they do everything in their power to somehow justify it as legitimate. Well, there's a whole bunch of other things I'm sure that we have learned, but perhaps tonight we just like to think of this. There is a contrast here going on between Esther and Daniel, or at least the book of Esther and Daniel. that is clearly set up. They're about the same time in history. They both face, in a sense, the same situation. And as you read it, the one who stands and identifies himself and is willing to stand for all of his convictions, who should have been killed, is the one who lives and gets promoted. And the one who is unwilling to do that is the one who, at this point at least, is going downhill. And I trust that as we continue in our study, we'll try to keep asking the question, okay, so why do we not know the extent to which they were godly or ungodly? The truth is, as you know, there is nobody as godly as they should be, and there's probably nobody as evil as they could be. And Mordecai and Esther are somewhere in the spectrum, as are all of us. But we still want to know, are they basically good people, or are they basically self-centered evil people avoiding their God? And we'll deal with that as we make our way through. But hopefully we learn this, if nothing else. Hiding your identity didn't work so well, Mordecai. And God help us not to be ashamed of who we are. We are the people of God. And the people out there might not all like it when you say you're a child of the King. You might be very prone, because our nature is we don't like to ruffle feathers and we don't like to have people upset with us. We might be very prone to somehow hide our identity. I was talking with somebody the other day, and he had come to know Christ as Savior. He got so excited about it, he witnessed to the guy he worked with for 12 years, I think it was a long period of time. And when he witnessed the guy that he had worked with for 12 years, the guy said, "Well, I'm already a Christian." But he had never known it. Why would we hide our identity? Do we think we'll get the promotion? Do we think people really like us? Do we think we won't face decrees? I think Mordecai learned something, and we see a transformation now in his character as he turns himself around and he turns Esther around and they turn and make their way out. Let's look to the Lord in prayer. Father, we thank you for this passage and pray that your Spirit would use it in our lives for your glory. And Father, if nothing else, maybe we could learn that we need to dare to be a Daniel and we need to avoid being a Mordecai, that we need to be a people who are not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, and we're not ashamed of who we are. And we cannot fool ourselves into thinking that hiding our identity will exempt us from problems and exalt us to promotions. I pray, Father, that we are a people who can learn from Mordecai's mistakes, but we also see his tremendous transformation now. And we'll thank you for that in Jesus' name. Amen.